Monday, June the 4th, and you're listening to Democracy's Demise here on CHUO 89.1 FM. And today's program, we have a lot of discussion and information and views and opinions to talk about, especially with all of the events that are coming up this week. And today, I had a discussion earlier this morning with Professor Norman Cornett from Montreal, who is the, best known for being the creator of the dialogic philosophy of education. And he also specializes in American politics. He has a PhD in the relations between religion, culture, and politics. And so he has some very specific and well-worked out views of his own with regards to what is taking place in the Korean Peninsula. And so let's begin the interview that I had with Professor Norman Cornett earlier today.
Thank you, Mr. Lang, for this invitation to speak on your program with CHOU. I consider it a privilege to collaborate with you, and most timely to address the issue of North Korea and Donald Trump and what's happening in the big picture of politics. And it would behoove us to look a little bit at the history of the Korean Peninsula, specifically the beginning of what we know as the Cold War and the rise of communist China, right, played out there in Korea. In 1950, the war began. It proved brutal, bloody. It ostensibly involved the United States of America with other allies under the aegis of the newly born United Nations. It was quite strategic in view of containing communism, which was the priority for the American president and policy. Harry Truman and mm-hmm. Dwight Eisenhower followed. And it's the first time that what we know as jets, military jets, are integrated into battle. Mm-hmm. So it takes warfare to a new level, which explains the casualty, what took place there. And it's important for all of us to remember that that war ended in 1953 with an armistice, not a peace treaty. So that, technically speaking, the United States and North Korea are still at war. And that, of course, is true of North Korea and South Korea. This was the theater in which China began to assert itself as a major power and at the forefront of communism's advance. Mm-hmm. As we know, General Douglas MacArthur came in, won a major victory that turned the tide in this war and went all the way up to the Yalu River, and indeed wanted to take the war to China. And this would have proven a game changer. That was not his mandate, and President Harry Truman relieved him, and that's putting it nicely, of his duties. Explains one of the reasons Douglas MacArthur went down as a war hero, somebody who dared to take the fight to the enemy on the enemy's home turf. That is what he had envisaged. And since then, it's imperative that we also recall that North Korea owes its very existence to the People's Republic of China. It is a vassal of what used to be called Red China. It could not have divided the Korean Peninsula. It could not have maintained its own identity, its own political regime, without out the People's Republic of China. And this is now becoming the front line between the United States and China. It is quite clear that Donald Trump, he said it throughout the presidential campaign, he was going to take it to the Chinese in economic terms. He was going to slap them with tariffs, and that is exactly what he has done. And he's going to repeat it loud and clear. I promised it in the campaign, and I'm keeping my promise. That is part of his domestic political strategy. That's that right. He wants to communicate in no uncertain terms that what he said he would do during the presidential campaign, well, now he's doing it. And that is that's a game changer.
Yes, it
that
is
a watershed in American politics. Mm-hmm. So for us to understand why Donald Trump is conducting American foreign policy like this, and specifically in the Asian theater, we need to remember that what's driving this is his policy of America first, make America great again.
Right.
And part of that is asserting the American presence, not to say predominance, in the Asian geopolitical situation.
Yes.
And in this vein, we can just think of General Mattis, his defense secretary, who a few days ago in a conference in Asia said unequivocally that China is using intimidation and coercion in the South China Sea. So what we realize is that unlike his predecessors, Donald Trump has shifted the political axis from Europe and the traditional post-World War II allies. Mm-hmm. He has shifted the political axis to Asia because that's where the people are, that's where the money is.
Well, I think, you know, you're making a very good point about the emphasis that is being put on Asia, but the other thing that I think we should add is that it was actually under Obama when Hillary Clinton was his Secretary of State when the policy of pivoting to Asia began. So the U.S. actually has been paying a lot of attention and trying to move a lot of their emphasis to Asia. And I agree with you, though, that that Trump has, whereas Obama was trying to maintain his allies in Europe, now Trump is completely concentrated on this. But in terms of this issue of the game-changing situation, I think the recent examples of the efforts of the in both Koreas for reunification has become a very important aspect, which has forced the Trump administration, I think, to change their approach in a certain way, because whereas before they talked about the importance of regime change and talking about the administration in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea as being out of control, now they're talking about negotiating with them. How do you see the developments on the Korean Peninsula as influencing the foreign policy that is being followed by the U.S. administration?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And in one sense, Trump has taken... he's taking China to task. We're seeing this with the tariffs he's just slapped on. Mm-hmm. And so with Mike Pompeo and certainly John Bolton, who has made it clear his position, one refers to the stick and the carrot, and John Bolton responded, "With me, there is no carrot. It's just the stick." And keep in mind, what's part of the American collective consciousness in political policy is the phrase of Theodore Roosevelt, you know, talk softly and carry a big stick.
Right.
And that's what Trump's doing. In the eyes of many, what was happening with the previous administration was, for them, appeasement.
Mm-hmm.
We should not appease the Chinese. We should confront the Chinese. We should get tough with the Chinese. We should have negotiations that put their feet to the fire economically, because we, if we're talking supply-side economics, if we're talking the market, well, we're the ones who have the big end of the stick, mm-hmm. because we are their market. And let me say, Mr. Lang,
yes.
Trump often likes to compare himself to Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan had a similar, and I'm a graduate of the University of California, Berkeley,
right.
and my diploma is signed by the chairman of the board of the University of California at the time, Governor Ronald Reagan. The governor of California is always the chairman of the board of the University of California. And Reagan decided he was going to get tough with the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and he was going to take Gorbachev. We all remember his speech in the former East Berlin at the Brandenburg Gates.
Yeah.
He calls out, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear this wall down."
Right.
Well, we can see as coherence begins to take shape in Trump American foreign policy that what Reagan did with the Soviet Union and Gorbachev,
mm-hmm.
Trump is aiming to do with China. And this is the game, this is the watershed in American politics. That this doesn't mean that they won't negotiate and reach an agreement, as indeed we all remember
mm-hmm.
who follow American foreign policy and politics, and particularly the end of the Iron Curtain. We all remember Reagan and Gorbachev meeting in Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have thought this arch anti-communist
mm-hmm.
would come to terms with the head of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened. Mm-hmm. And we can see that this is the tactic, this is the strategy, this is the rationale of Mike Pompeo, of John Bolton, and Donald Trump aiming for this.
Mm-hmm.
But you're very... and so North Korea becomes the thin edge of the wedge in mm-hmm. this. It is a client state of China.
Mm-hmm.
If the United States can succeed first in ending officially, legally, formally, the war in Korea, going from armistice to a true peace treaty... Well, Trump is very much looking out for Trump's own interest, and he is salivating to get the Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm, that's for
and
sure.
He will get it if that happens.
My God. What a thought.
What an irony.
Yeah,
he will get it if he brings the Korean War to an end through an armistice. And it is no coincidence, Mr. Lang, that where is Ambassador Sung Kim, the American ambassador, former ambassador to South Korea under Barack Obama,
mm-hmm.
and now currently ambassador to the Philippines. He's highly regarded mm-hmm. as a good negotiator. He was born in Seoul, so he speaks, he knows the culture, he speaks the language.
Mm-hmm.
Where is he right now? In Panmunjom, where the armistice was signed, where Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in met.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all fraught with... This is in the heart of the DMZ, the peace village.
Mm-hmm.
This is all fraught with historical and political significance and implications. So we can see that Trump and his administration consider the relationship between North Korea and South Korea as the catalyst to bring coherency to American policy and presence. I hasten to point out
mm-hmm.
that General Mattis, the defense secretary, a few days ago no longer refers to the Pacific theater.
Mm-hmm.
He now refers to it as the Indo-Pacific region. That is very purposeful, because the South China Sea, the islands that China is militarizing and it now even has nuclear bomb capable, has bombers that can carry nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. They're landing on these islands.
Yes.
It's very clear that the United States has decided now is the time we must act to counter, to provide a counterweight to the militarization of the South China Sea. So they're proposing the Indo-Pacific region as a counterweight to the growing influence and zone of China throughout Asia. That is also why Donald Trump will be meeting once again with Prime Minister Abe of Japan, so that we see the United States is shoring up its Asian allies, its Asian presence. And if there is unification of the Korean Peninsula, and that's a big if, Mr. Lang.
That is, yeah.
First of all, this would heal the biggest open wound in Asia that is now decades ongoing.
I agree.
And there is both in North Korea and South Korea has an entire ministry devoted to unification.
Oh, yes. There's a huge sentiment for it. Yeah.
My thesis supervisor for my PhD was German, and he was utterly convinced that never could there be unification between East Germany and West Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we learned from that is never say never.
That's right.
I myself often go to the former GDR, used to be called East Germany, Communist Germany.
Mm-hmm.
It is an economic miracle going on there, Lang.
That's interesting.
What is Mike Pompeo? What is the Trump administration holding out to Kim Jong-un, holding out to North Korea? If we can come to terms on the peace treaty, we will extend a hand of friendship to your infrastructure, which badly needs foreign assistance. We will extend it to your economy. We will extend it so that you have a prosperous country. Now, make no mistake, this is a threat to China.
Of course.
And that explains why during the second trip of Kim Jong-un to meet the president of China, why all of a sudden the rhetoric returned to that bellicose, that aggressive.
Yes.
So Kim Jong-un right now is playing out his future, Mr. Lang, between the United States and China. And the United States, this would be in many respects, not only for the Americans, but for the Koreans.
Yes.
The unification of Korea would be a dream come true. Wow. This is a civilization. This is a culture. This is a people whose very existence has been played out over millennia between the Japanese and the Chinese.
Yes, yes.
But they are a culture. They are a people. They are an entire identity.
They do have.
It goes back for centuries and centuries and centuries,
yes.
So that they would be the pawns between capitalists and communists. They want a say in their own future.
Of course.
They don't want to keep living out that we have to be the victims of the big players in Asia.
In that sense, I just wanted to ask what your opinion was about when you were talking about what's driving American foreign policy. I think that the issue of Trump canceling the meeting and then the meeting taking place between Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in on the 26th of May, which reaffirmed the necessity for continuing the discussions and arriving at some conclusion, and then Trump changing his mind. Like, to what extent is American foreign policy driving this, and to what extent is the sentiment of the Korean people for reunification also an important factor in this whole context?
Well, what is these are very good questions. First, keep in mind, until recently, North Korea in general and Kim Jong-un in particular were considered absolute pariahs mm-hmm. on the international scene. This was the hermit kingdom. They had relationships with virtually no one. Right. They were totally dependent on the People's Republic of China. So we can see on the part of North Korea and Kim Jong-un this endeavor to break out of their shell, to break out of this total dependency on China, mm-hmm. and to start to establish an international profile, yeah. to start being considered as valid partners in international relations and in the worldwide economy.
Yes.
In actual fact, the one who's really winning and already has won is Kim Jong-un.
That's right. I agree.
And I said the United States, it really looks good in the eyes of American to be, it looks all American to take on China. Mm-hmm. It looks like this is the American spirit to take on China. And this, it looks like Trump is not appeasing China by slapping on these tariffs. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, it looks good. But I have to ask myself, Mr. Lang,
yeah.
is Trump not appeasing nuclear weapons and the threat? Because why did Donald Trump receive as a welcome, honored guest, the right-hand man of Kim Jong-un just a few days ago?
That's right.
Who was treated with the utmost respect. The President of the United States of America giving this kind of preferential treatment mm-hmm. to people who just a few months ago were testing nuclear bombs
yes.
and ballistic and intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Yes.
Is that not appeasement?
Of course it is. I think it's an important factor, too.
And so this, unfortunately, I think Trump is sending mixed messages. The next dictator, the next totalitarian, the next person who wants to grab and keep the attention of the United States of America and be given the seat of honor at the dining table of the White House,
mm-hmm.
they're going to follow what Kim Jong-un did.
Mm-hmm.
And they're certainly all remembering what happened with Muammar Gaddafi,
oh, that's
who
right.
did give up his, though it was not near as developed, who did give up the pursuit of nuclear capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So the message that Donald Trump is sending, on one, it's a short-term gain in some respects,
mm-hmm.
but it's not going to be lost on any despot.
Hmm.
If you want to deal on first name basis with Donald Trump, then do what Kim Jong-un did.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Cornett, for your insights. And I'm sure that as the situation develops, we'll be talking to you again soon. So thanks
a lot. Well, thank you, Mr. Lang, for the privilege to speak with you and with the listeners of CHOU.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.